we're talking about Carl Jung, the one of the founding fathers of modern psychoanalysis. Gary Lachman writes about him in Jung, the Mystic, the esoteric dimensions of Carl Jung's life and teachings. He talks about the paranormal in Carl Jung's life. And yet, at the same time, Carl Jung, he's still hugely influential to this day. If, as I said, you've ever taken, you know, Myers-Briggs, you've been influenced by Carl Jung. Your future may have been decided by Carl Jung's writings in a way. If you've ever been in a 12-step program, you've been influenced by the work of Carl Jung. And yet, he's got this other aspect to him, too. And I'll ask Gary about that last book he wrote. I believe it was the last book he published, was about UFOs. We'll talk about that this half hour, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So we're talking with Gary Lachman about Carl Jung, the Mystic, and I threw out there this idea. When is psychoanalysis, when is it just mysticism? When is it something of the occult? Gary?
Oh, well, I mean, I guess these days a lot of clinical psychologists or people in pharma psychology would consider psychoanalysis, any form of it, some kind of mysticism or occultism or superstition, because their work is all based on, you know, drug therapies. It's all, you know, if you feel depressed or something or whatever, there's a problem, you take this sort of drug and it'll deal with the situation. And you were saying earlier how, you know, someone who went into, a contemporary psychiatrist's office and started talking about the experiences that Jung relates in his early years, that they would likely get prescriptions for Prozac. And I think in many ways that approach suggests that it's more about sort of behavioral control, you know, making sure you sort of, you keep in step, you know, you don't, doesn't interfere with your job, doesn't interfere with anything, you just keep going along and, you know, it's fine, you know, we got a pill for it. And that's much, very much the opposite of what Jung himself would have been interested in, because it wasn't, to him, it wasn't about, I mean, one of the main differences between Jung and Freud, was Freud, his aim is basically to, you know, you go through all this therapy and at the end you'll be a well-adjusted individual, you'll fit into society, you'll have a nice marriage and all that and, you know, everything. And Jung said, well, it could be that fitting into society, it could be that nice marriage itself is producing the problems, and you're really trying to fit yourself into some mold that you don't belong in, and there's something in you that's more than that that needs to come out, and that it isn't coming out for some reason. That's what's causing the problem. So again, it's getting back to what I said earlier. For Jung, you know, neurotic symptoms were a good sign.
Right.
They were a sign that there was something in the psyche that was healthy and wanted to deal with the situation, and was, you know, making attempts to do it. So, I mean, in many ways, Jung's psychology is more about, like, yes, go crazy. Let's get a safe environment for you to go crazy in.
Go get a motorcycle, drive across country, get a girlfriend, you know, live, man,
yeah, exactly.
Live.
Yeah. It was just to jump ahead a little bit. I mean, for Jung himself, he went through this crisis when his friendship and sort of partnership with Freud fell apart. And he had this, you know, massive nervous breakdown. But he sort of cured himself of it by developing this relationship with his unconscious, with the symbols and the dream images and the trance states and the paranormal events. And he realized that, well, you know, if I could go from that to being, quote, normal, why can't I keep going
right.
and go beyond normal, you know, go into this more psychically integrated state. And this is what his latest psychology is about. Now, that sort of thing, this is what was picked up by, you know, the human potential movement, self-help movements, you know, a variety of new age sort of movements, this whole idea that you could be more than just normal. And this is the stuff that a lot of, you know, mainstream psychiatrists think, oh, that's a wacky kind of new age, fluffy, mystical kind of stuff. I mean, for me, it's what makes Jung interesting and important.
Well, it's what makes any of us, I think, interesting and important, and that is to realize that normal is overrated.
Hmm.
You know, I mean,
who decides what is normal? What powers are at work deciding, you know, okay, well, this is what's considered normal. And this is what, you know, we should all sort of try to aspire to this particular kind of set of behaviors rather than, you know, those.
But what an indictment of modern psychoanalysis, though, because that essentially makes the people, the pill dispensers and the, you know, the serum developers. And I know that I'm not saying that they have evil in their hearts or that they're wrong or that there aren't people that benefit from SSRIs or whatever, but it makes them mechanics. You know, that makes them nothing more than just mechanics. They take a reading, your viscosity is down. Let's go ahead and put a couple of quarts in here. That's all it is. You don't break through to some other part of you. You simply get enough lubrication to be able to keep the wheels turning.
Well, you're absolutely right. Because most of us, they don't think there is any other part. I mean, there isn't anything other than sort of the psycho, you know, somatic relationship. You know, you're basically a kind of collection of chemicals that interact in certain ways inside ourselves. And when, you know, you have too much of one, you need a little bit more, you know, of that to,
right.
You know, to get it. And it's got nothing to do with some sense of there being, I mean, the thing about Jung that I've found inspiring and encouraging since I was a teenager when I first started reading them is this whole idea that there's something more, you know, there's a bigger you in there somewhere. And the whole idea of life is to gradually have that come out and to keep maturing over time. And it wasn't like, okay, this is it. You get married, you have kids, you have a career, they're 40, it's over, and then the rest of the time you just basically have to take antidepressants so that you don't kill yourself.
Right.
I mean, his whole view was, you know, the exact opposite of that. And it's predicated on the sense that there is, again, this gets into an occult sense, there's something other than what scientists can detect. There's something other than what we can see, you know, taste, hear, and feel. There's some other thing in there. We used to call it the soul back when had more of a religious sense. We don't really use that word so much anymore. We don't really have a handy word for it anymore.
We should.
Jung tends to, he calls it the self with a capital S.
Yeah, but I think the soul is still good, and I think spirit is still good too. And I think that I've always regretted that, like when the original headline for when the Titanic sank, the headline in the Chicago Tribune read "Titanic sinks, 1,500 souls lost," and I think that's actually truer than 1,500 deaths. You know, I think there's something that's more profound about, you know, death is inevitable to us all, but there's something about the losing of a soul. That's what we should really be mourning, is when we lose the essence of what that person was and the library, the walking library that they had become of their experiences and knowledge and whatever. I think that's a much more profound loss than just a human, you know, death.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, because it encompasses the totality of the person. I mean, you say 15,000 lives lost. It's almost like a biological kind of statement.
Right. Okay. So exactly.
This organic thing is no longer living. It's dead now.
Right.
I think,
I'm sorry. Sometimes it's a delay from the long distance.
I mean, he along with all the paranormal events in his life, he also had a very long, deep relationship with the dead. This is something that doesn't come out in a lot of the sort of stuff written about Jung, and something that he himself kept for his sort of closest colleagues or some of his patients, where he would, in some of his lectures and some of his talks, he talked about the relationship with the dead and how in many ways the dead need us. They, rather than, you know, many cases with seances and spiritualism, you know, it's sort of the one-way street where we're asking the dead questions. You know, we want to get answers from them. But Jung argued actually it's the opposite way around. The dead need us. There's things left undone from their lives that they need our help in order to fulfill, so they can move on themselves.
Right.
And again, this is something that, with his grandfather, whom he didn't know, but he heard stories about, he had a relationship with, you know, the dead around him. And then Jung himself, his early years started with these sort of things. His early experiences in scientifically trying to understand paranormal activity were through seances, where one of his cousins fell into these trance states, and she spoke in the voice of, both of Jung's deceased grandfathers. So that was something that was there all along, and you know, he always had a sense that there was something more. You know, there wasn't just just the biological entity. There was something else that was somehow housed in the body, continued in some way to have an existence after the body died.
Well, pardon me for, I haven't finished reading it. I will. Jung the Mystic. So maybe you talk about this, but let me just ask you, have you seen the Red Book? Are you one of the few people who have seen the Red Book?
Well, I did see it. I had to wait till it was available in, at a research library here because I couldn't afford to buy a copy. It's cost prohibitive. But no, it's a fantastic work. And some of the
this is explain the Red Book for people that don't know what it is.
Okay. Well, the Red Book was this sort of dream journal, diary, sort of spiritual diary that Jung kept during this crisis he went through. I mentioned a little while ago that Jung had this sort of psychic crisis, existential crisis that he went through following his breakup of his friendship with Freud. And Jung basically thought he was going mad after years of working with psychotic and schizophrenic patients in a clinic. He started to see many of the same symptoms in himself. He started having these trance states. He would go into these waking visions. He would have visions of this sort of apocalypse coming over Europe, and so on. And in order to kind of keep a lid on it, he started writing them down and painting images that he saw in his dreams and in these visions. And this is what became the Red Book. It's called the Red Book. This is basically a big, fat, leather-bound, red-colored folio, a diary. And he wrote in this fantastically meticulous calligraphy, these sort of dream narratives or waking state sort of visions that he went on. He developed a method of sort of dreaming while awake, to put it in the simplest terms. He could fall into this sort of waking dream state where he could watch the dreams take place, and he could also still be critically aware of them. He wasn't completely immersed in them. He retained his sort of critical consciousness. And then he painted these images, and they're fantastic, like these sort of psychedelic pop art kind of images. They're incredibly vividly colored and intricate, so much detail of these entities that he encountered in these trance states he went into. When I say that, Jung believed that there are these intelligences that lived in his head, basically. We'll put it another way, that they shared the same psychic space in which his personality existed. So just as we all share this outer world, you know, I'm looking out my window now and I see trees and houses and clouds and all that, and this is something that anybody else looking out their window is going to see. Jung believed that in our inner world, we have a similar inner space that we share with other beings. And he encountered some of these in these trance states. And they talked to him, and they told him things. They told him things about that inner world. They told him things about himself, about their self, about their life. And he kept this record of this for, well, it started about 1913, and he kept doing it. The crisis ended about right after the end of World War I, to say about 1919, but then he kept adding to the book for another 10 years or so. But Jung is so ambivalent about this sort of thing. I said before that, you know, he was insistent that he was a scientist. So in a way, he didn't want to be too open about this because he thought, you know, well, people just think I'm crazy and
right.
they won't take my science seriously. But he kept it a secret, and he kept it locked away. And for many years, he stopped tinkering with it. About 1930, he put it in a cupboard in his home in Zurich, and left it there. And it stayed in that cupboard until sometime in the 80s. I mean, the family, you know, kept the house. And then it was moved to a bank vault. And it was there, remained there until last year when it was published, a little more than a year ago, in the fall of 2009. And if you know that at the time, it created a big stir. I mean, the New York Times devoted 10 pages to it, which is unusual because they're not particularly kind to Jung, mostly. They're more sort of on the Freudian side of it, I would say. So they devoted 10 pages to it. And it was a big, big, big to-do in the publishing world.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say...
In the Red Book, he does talk about some of his encounters with the dead.
Yeah. And it was kept under, obviously, lock and key for a long time as people were... People controlling Jung's image thought that that would feed the wrong side of it. What about his last book on UFOs? It surprised me to read about that, although it doesn't surprise me that for Carl Jung, it would be all about the symbolism of UFOs. Mm-hmm. But did he ever see one himself?
Well, it wasn't exactly his last book. It was one of his last, but it was pretty close. I think there was one other after it. And then the Memories, Dreams, Reflection were the sort of ghost-written autobiography. But, well, he doesn't talk so much about seeing them himself. He talks of them as these sort of psychic projections. We mentioned this word mandala earlier. And mandalas are these sort of circular, well, it's a Sanskrit word meaning magic circle. So they're these circular images that Jung believe the psyche produces, both as a sign of its own kind of psychic state and also as a means of sort of reaching a greater integrity. And Jung believed that flying saucers, because they were round, you know, the early ones were considered, you know, round, circular shaped, that somehow the collective psyche of the whole planet was projecting these things into the sky because of the tensions of the Cold War. He believed that, you know, the West had become schizophrenic, where you have the USA on one side and the USSR on the other, and, you know, there are guys with the fingers over the buttons to, you know, shoot the missiles off on either side. And this tension, this sort of, you know, pressure produced these, it sort of prompted the psyche, the collective psyche, to produce these images. And Jung, he said it's called the UFO, a modern myth of things seen in the sky. And he basically was saying this is a way of the collective psyche to somehow reach some sort of unity or some sense of healing itself because of those pressures. And it's a funny thing that Jung, he had been interested in UFOs from the beginning. He sort of read lots of accounts of it, and in correspondence he talked about it. But again, it took him quite some time to sort of come out in the open and talk about it. And there's a famous story where Charles Lindbergh, you know, the pilot, visits Jung in Zurich, and Lindbergh himself was pretty skeptical about UFOs, and he presented Jung with a lot of evidence that, oh, you know, it's just kind of a hoax or whatever, and Jung pretty much just sort of ignored it. He didn't want to know about it. He didn't want to know about any of the sort of the physical evidence, and whether they were physical objects or not, he kind of, you know, he didn't think that was that important. He was more interested in their psychic, the psychological meaning. But this sort of stuff all came out after Jung himself had a near-death experience.
Well, let's talk.
He was very interested in paranormal throughout his life. But it wasn't until... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm almost afraid of getting too deep into that because I'd only have to stop you just as you're getting into. So let's hold on Carl Jung's near-death experience, because in a way we actually had a big book on that a couple of weeks ago where we were talking to the author, the most comprehensive study so far on near-death experiences, and that was really interesting for just many of the reasons that I was finding Jung the mystic interesting, is that people, no matter what their religious background or non-religious background, often had very similar experiences with slight colorizations depending on if they were Christian or if they were Muslim, or but they all kind of had this kind of the same thing. And this was done as a part of a comprehensive six hospital study that just came out after 25 years of this research. It was great. So, all right, so we'll talk about that. Carl Jung's near-death experience, how it changed his life on the way. And we were talking about how psychology is not really a science. I'm not taking a hard position against psychology. I find it very informative. I've rather liked all of my psychological stuff I've had to go through over the years for ordination and that kind of thing. But is it true... And I'd like to ask Gary Lachman, who both studied Carl Jung and also has studied mysticism and the occult, that maybe psychology is just a great way of collecting common sense. Just collecting common sense. We'll talk about that vis-a-vis Carl Jung, too, coming up. And his near-death experience next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, of course, it's the big fifth anniversary of the big uneasy, of the devastation of New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And in the first hour of Coast to Coast, we are talking with Harry Shearer, whose new movie, The Big Uneasy, will only be shown in theaters very likely for just one night, coming up Monday night. You can link up to him by going to coasttocoastam.com and going to his website for The Big Uneasy. and finding that theater near you that's showing it Monday night. DVD comes out probably later on in the year, but it's getting great reviews. And Harry, of course, is an old friend. And so I can't recommend it enough. Monday night, The Big Uneasy, on this sad anniversary of the Katrina-ravaged New Orleans, or as Harry would point out, not ravaged by Katrina, but ravaged by human idiocy, by human failure, our unwillingness to see, even when we have it down on paper, that something won't work and is, you know, bound to be doomed or doomed to bind us, as is what happens post-Katrina. So just find out more. And if you have a stream link, I guess now called Coast Insider, go back and check out that first hour with Harry Shearer, the near-death and paranormal experiences of Carl Jung. And we'll talk a little bit more, too, about psychoanalysis as mysticism on the way, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about Carl Jung, one of the founding fathers of modern psychology. But, you know, I mentioned earlier, Gary, I said if you've ever taken the Myers-Briggs personality assessment, if you've ever been in a 12-step program, I should also mention that if you've ever had art therapy, you were influenced by the writing of Carl Jung, right? He's generally credited as being the father of art therapy, I think, the painting and making the symbols that are floating around your head and putting them up on a page and seeing what they mean to you. And then Carl Jung also spent a life having paranormal experiences and studying mysticism and the occult. He was, by some people's measure, a mystic himself. And his first paper, I had to look it up, his dissertation published in 1903 was on the psychology and pathology of so-called occult phenomena. What did he mean by so-called occult phenomena?
Well, it's a scientific paper. He did it for his, getting his degree. And he, even though he was very much interested in spiritualism, and again, at this time, a lot of the most famous academics, intellectuals in the world then were actually openly interested in paranormal. The American philosopher and psychologist William James is one classic example. But still, Jung felt that because it was an academic paper, you know, he had to couch his terms in rather academic, restrained way. And the so-called occult phenomena were, as I mentioned earlier, these seances that he attended with a cousin of his, who incidentally was more than likely in love with Jung, and Jung probably knew about it at the time. She was about 15, and he was, I think, in his early 20s. And in the paper, Jung, this is the beginning of this sort of ambivalent I don't want to say duplicitous, but the cagey way that Jung presented his relationship to paranormal for most of his career, where he played down his own involvement in the seances. He presented himself as this sort of detached, you know, scientific observer. He didn't mention that the medium was his cousin. He didn't mention, you know, their sort of relationship. He didn't mention that they had been going on for a very, very long time. So initially, his first sort of outing into the occult, you know, sort of world in the public view, he hedged his bets. He played his cards close to his chest. I just want to mention one thing. You were saying that, you know, Jung was responsible for the Myers-Briggs and so on. He's also he was also one of the early people developing lie detectors.
Very good. Didn't know that
one as well.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, it goes to show you his brilliance, but also to his openness, because the near-death experience of which you speak, I think this is something, again, which a lot of people today, if you went into a psychologist's office and you started talking about a near-death experience, if you even try talking about it with the doctor that was in the operating room while you were having it, you'd be treated like you need help.
Give more drugs.
Yeah, given more drugs, exactly. Or just told that what you experienced was a result of drugs, when clearly a lot of people experience these things and they're completely drug-free at the time. But, all right, so talk about Carl Jung's near-death experience then.
Well, what had happened is it was just towards the end of World War II. It was 1944. Jung was about 68, 69, and it was in February, and he was taking a walk, and he slipped on some ice. And he broke his leg, basically. And in the hospital, when he was, like in a cast, he developed a blood clot, and it led to a heart attack. So he had a heart attack in the hospital. And because of this, he went into this sort of a coma, or a deep, sort of state of, depending on your perspective, delirium. But for Jung, what had happened was that he found himself floating above the Earth. He was about 1,000 miles up in orbit. He could see the continents below. And he saw this sort of black kind of monolith, like maybe something out of Stanley Kubrick, 2001, sort of, floating near him. And he seemed to be moving closer and closer towards it. And then it turned out to be kind of a Hindu temple. And there's all candles burning and all that. And inside, Jung knew that he was going to meet all the people who had been very, very important in his life, and all the answers to the mysteries that had obsessed him his whole life, the secret of the meaning of life and so on. These are going to be revealed to him. And just as he was about to touch base on the temple, he saw the figure of his doctor floating up from the planet below. And his doctor had come to ferry Jung back, and Jung didn't want to go back, as many people who experienced near-death states do. He was very reluctant to return to Earth, and his doctor had to convince him, no, there are dozens of women down there who are saying, no, you can't go, we don't want you to leave yet. And so Jung very reluctantly agreed to go back, and he found himself back in his hotel room, his hospital room and all that. And strangely enough, Jung felt that because his doctor had come to save him, he in some way had sacrificed his own life. And strangely enough, on the first day that Jung could sort of sit up in bed and seem to be on the mend, his doctor took ill, and he had caught septicemia. And a few days after that, his doctor died.
But I'll Jung be had, darned.
Had somehow had a premonition that his own doctor was going to die, and he did. And then Jung continued to be in these sort of trance states while he was recovering in hospital. He would have these visions at night, these sort of Kabbalistic visions of this kind of holy marriage and so on and so on. And what this did is it kind of chastened Jung. He started to ease up on this insistence that he was a scientist, and ease up the other way, sort of open up more about his involvement or relationship or interest in the occult. And this is when he starts to talk about these things openly. I mean, he had been using the Chinese divinatory method, the I Ching, the coins that you throw down and you make these hexagrams, and they can give you some sort of reading of
right.
the event and the future and so on. He'd
right.
been using those for decades and decades and decades. But it wasn't until after this near-death experience that he kind of came out in the open and talked about it. And he wrote this introduction to one of the translations of the book, which is the one that everybody in the 1960s and 70s had. He felt like, well, he basically felt it's kind of pointless to keep hammering away that I'm a scientist and not to be open about this. And he felt that he was given an opportunity to come back in order to sort of spread the word, as it were. And this is when he starts talking about alchemy a lot. He starts talking about flying saucers. He starts talking about the age of Aquarius. Jung was talking about that
right.
in the 40s, you know.
Well, you mentioned the heart attack thing, and that actually is the most that's the typical heart attack near-death experience. The heart stops working for some period of time, so there is a physical trajectory toward permanent death that's going on the table, but inside the person has never felt more alive, and they have the cardiac patients. Actually, is what this doctor that we had on a couple of weeks ago. That's what he studied was the typical cardiac arrest a near-death experience, or somebody might actually be dead on an operating table for minutes at a time before their heart is able to start pumping again. And in the meantime, all of these things that they know, the experience, very close to what Jung experienced, although that's the first time I've ever heard of a doctor coming, like the spirit of a doctor coming to get a patient and bring them back to the operating room. I've never heard of that before. I mean, that's really interesting. I'll have to mention that to the doctor we had on a couple of weeks ago. So what would be then, I mean, if we had to go through all of the various potential paranormal experiences, can we check them off for Carl Jung? Ghosts, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Ghosts, precognitive experiences, forms of telepathy.
Telepathy?
And of course, he was the one who developed the whole notion of synchronicity, you know, meaningful coincidence. He coined the term. I don't know. I mean, they're all there. I mean, sadly, I think what Jung tried to do once he invented this term synchronicity, he tried to explain all paranormal phenomena by synchronicity. So in a way, he came up with a very useful term, but I think he overused it. But certainly ESP. I mean, the whole if you read his book on synchronicity, which he published in the early 50s, he basically does that. He runs the gamut. He even tries to explain astrology through it. But I mean, it's like telekinesis, poltergeist phenomena. I mean, probably the most famous of those is the incident of the poltergeist in Freud's bookcase.
I didn't hear that. I didn't read that. So I didn't tell me about that.
I'll tell you shortly. Jung was visiting Freud in Vienna. This is when they were still working together. And they sort of had a father-son relationship. Freud was about 25 years older than Jung. And he expected Jung to sort of, you know, inherit psychoanalysis from him and carry it on. They were discussing occult phenomena, paranormal phenomena, and Jung was talking about how he believed somehow the poltergeist phenomena were somehow triggered by the unconscious. Somehow the unconscious mind could reach out into the physical world out there and manipulate it, and do something to it. And Freud, who was a strict rationalist, even though he himself had a lot of interest in paranormal, especially telepathy, but again, he kept it to himself. He basically said, "Oh, that's a lot of rubbish." And Jung started getting rather, you know, angry with Freud for dismissing all this stuff. And suddenly there was a loud bang in one of the bookcases. And Jung said, "You see there's exactly an example of what I was talking about." And Freud said, "Oh, come on, Carl, you know, it's just drying wood." And Jung got more and more exasperated with Freud. He said, "No, it wasn't. And there will be another bang just like it now." And then there was. There suddenly was this loud crack and bang.
Wow.
And he totally spooked Freud.
How about that?
Freud felt like, "Oh my God, you know, something really is happening here." And this is something that Freud mistrusted Jung after that. He felt Jung had some sort of power, you know.
Huh.
And there's a letter that Freud wrote to Jung about this incident later on, where he says, basically, "While you were here, I believed in it. But since you've gone and I've been, you know, on my own, I've seen the reason and something." So basically, he talked himself out of it. But while Jung was around him, somehow Jung's own presence, he had what the Polynesians call mana. It kind of, you know, radiated out of him, and it convinced Freud that, yeah, actually something's going on here.
So, again, the title of the book, Gary Lachman's book, is Jung the Mystic. And that is something which he resisted in his lifetime, and some Jungians to this day would decry and say that's so wrong to describe him that way. Why do you think Carl Jung was a mystic?
Well, I mean, in a way, when I initially thought of the book, I wanted to put a question mark after Jung the mystic, but I thought that would be, you know, too sort of too obvious way to put it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he certainly interested himself and involved himself in a variety of different things that would be considered, you know, mystical by a straight, you know, straightforward rational scientist. I think he's not a mystic in the sense that he tried to understand these things. He tried to understand and tried to come up with a language, you know, to talk about them. Most mystics don't do that. It's the experience itself that is enough. As I said earlier, you know, this sense of being absorbed into the larger entity, some transcendental entity of some kind. If they try to describe it, it's in terms of religious language, where Jung tried to describe it I guess you could call it scientific or basically in the way that he wanted to describe it and say, well, this is when this happens, this is what's taking place. So in that sense, I wouldn't call him a mystic, but he's a mystic in the sense that he was, very much a part of his life from the very beginning. I said earlier that he had these sort of two personalities when he was, adolescent. And something like that carried on for most of his career. There was a public face where he was Herr Dr. Professor, and he's always, puffing on the pipe, and he looks very scholarly and academic and sage-like and all that. And then there was his other side with his closer followers and patients, where he was openly discussing, talking to the dead, using astrology, using the I Ching and other forms of divination and stuff like that. So there were these two sides to him. And as I said, it wasn't until this near-death experience that he basically felt like, ooh, maybe I should be, a little more open about this and not be quite so cagey about it.
Well, maybe because there was two Carl Jungs, number one and the one that he referred to as number two, maybe that explains why he had a wife and then a series of girlfriends. If you've got two of you, you've got a lot to satisfy there.
Well, he would say, the archetypes made me do it in a way. He certainly had one lifelong mistress, a woman named Toni Wolff, who basically became part of the family. She started out, as many of Jung's followers did, as one of his patients. And he had this remarkable talent for enabling people to see themselves in a better light. Many people came to him, they were complete wrecks in the sense that they didn't know what to do with themselves, and they felt, completely disorientated, and they didn't know, where to go and all that. And he was somehow able to show them a way for them to find themselves. And this happened to quite a few of his women followers. Toni Wolff was one. There was a woman named Sabina Spielrein who was one of his early patients who he got into quite a lot of trouble with because they had an affair. Women found him very attractive. And his wife, Emma, he loved her deeply, and she had five children with him, but he felt that he somehow needed some other kind of contact with women. And it wasn't necessarily, just hopping in the sack with them. I think that certainly happened, but I think it was honestly something about, there was something that, some part of himself that couldn't actualize with Emma. Maybe that was the part that was, the everyday working hard, father, patriarch of the big family and all that. And to unwind and to open up, he needed something else. And this woman, Toni Wolff, she was the one who basically helped him get through this crisis. He would talk to her about the visions he had and these trance states he was going into and these images he was seeing, and she would try to help him understand them. And she had a way of somehow talking with him about it that apparently, for him at least, Emma couldn't. This is something that a lot of contemporary psychologists or people in the psychotherapeutic community kind of hold against him. This totally goes against all of the ethics about it now. The doctor and patient aren't supposed to, get involved in all that.
Yeah.
But back then, when he was first starting practicing, this is 1900 something. All that hadn't happened yet, so it was an open field.
Well, we're going to get to some questions here coming up for Gary Lachman, formerly of Blondie, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm guessing the only Jungian biographer who's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I think so. I think so. I don't think too many have gone on to do sorts of things I've been doing. I mean, I've written books on Rudolf Steiner and Manuel Swedenborg and...
Wait. Well, so. I believe one of the Shirelles wrote a book about Rudolf Steiner. I'm pretty sure. Check me on that, but I think so. All right, so your questions and comments about Carl Jung, but I think more than that, I really want to get to the question. I want to get back to something you brought up earlier about psychoanalysis as mysticism, as a form of mysticism, or more specifically, psychologists or psychiatrists as shamans, who are more likely to give you a pill than to give you talk therapy, more likely to give you a potion Any thought on that? Coming up next, Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.